Hi, hello, welcome. Welcome to the Psych Major. Today's topic is using the things we know from a long history of research in memory to develop useful and long-lasting study habits and tactics. The companion for this lecture is a slide deck called 1MAR23 Memory. You'll see in this we've got a new title slide that mentions that we are moving to online delivery, and we have a new schedule slide shortly after that that gives you the same things that the schedule already posted on Blackboard gives. So the point of this lecture is that number one, you get a basic set of information about how contemporary memory theorists think about the faculty of the mind that is memory, how people actually remember things. And this knowledge, this short education about how we think about memory, should give you really nice concrete ideas about how to study. I'll sort of take the theory and move it directly into application so that you can use some of these ideas to learn material for this course and all your courses more deeply and retain it longer. So firstly, let's define memory. Take a second for yourself. Think about how you would define memory. Write it down. I'm going to give you a minute to do this. Pause the recording if you want to take a couple minutes to think about it and write down a memory that's, or excuse me, write down a definition that's not not dictionary based, that's based in your own intuitions about what memory is. Probably the most widely accepted definition in the field of memory research is that established by Atkinson and Shiffrin in 1968, which says the following: memory is the faculty of the mind by which information is encoded, stored, and retrieved. We often put learning and memory together, especially colloquially, but in psychology, the concept of learning is quite distinct from this specific definition of memory. So we're going to stick specifically to memory for the courses or for the purposes of this lecture. So now think about whether you have a good memory. Do you feel like you have a pretty good memory? If we were in class, I'd survey the class. Raise your hand if you have a good memory, if you feel like you have a decent memory. And usually when I talk to people and ask them this question, either in person or in a larger format like in class, younger people tend to be fairly confident about their memories, and then older adults tend to be less so. One of the stories I tell all the time is that whenever I meet somebody on an airplane, say, and they ask what I do, and I say, well, I'm a psychologist, they first say, well, you must be analyzing me right now. And I say, no, I actually can't do that. I don't know how to do that. I'm an experimental researcher. I do research on memory. And they go, oh, you should study me. I have a terrible memory. And it's pretty universal. But in class, interestingly, when I survey rooms of undergraduates and say, do you feel like your memory is pretty good? Most people say theirs is decent. So that disconnect is an interesting question, one we won't address today, but something to think about moving forward. And use that maybe to think about whether your idea of whether you have a good memory may or may not be influenced by sources other than your use of your memory itself. Going to present to you today a description of memory that is based on the fact that we see quite clearly in most research that memory is constructive and you could also say reconstructive in nature. And what I mean when I say this is that memory and your ability to remember something depends on two factors. The first factor is what happened. So your memory contains some pieces of information from what happened at the time, but memory also depends on your knowledge, your experiences, and your expectations of, firstly, your memory of that event, but also of other similar events you've experienced, or knowledge you have about those kinds of events, the context surrounding the memory. It can, in some cases, be just as important as what actually happened in the moment, in the past in your life. Because of this, memory is not replayed like a video. It is not a perfect record. People's memories are flawed, most definitely. And you can see that all the time when people in public are asked to remember things. People who live public lives forget and misrepresent stories all the time. You maybe have had disagreements with siblings about the way a certain event transpired when you were younger, and that kind of thing. Is a yet more examples of the fact that memory is not replayed like a video, and in fact it is reconstructed based on these multiple pieces of information. What happened, yes, but also your knowledge, your expectations, and your experiences. I would actually say that memory is not a video camera playing back. It's actually more like a Wikipedia page. You can look it up. It'll link to all the relevant articles. Remembering the last movie you saw might lead you to remember a movie like it, or the movie you saw before that, who was in the movie, all that kind of stuff. But it also can be edited, and it can be edited by forces other than yourself, which can push it in and out of accuracy over time. One way in which it's not like Wikipedia is that memory generally fades over time, and so our recollection of the actual true event doesn't tend to be as strong long after the fact as it does shortly after it happened. So coupled with all these, think about how you study or how you memorize. When you want to know something, when you want to memorize something, when you want to put it in your memory, when you want to put it in your head, in your mind, what do you do to get there? Most people just try to absorb it on a really sort of superficial level. They'll read the thing they're supposed to memorize. Maybe they'll take some notes, and then maybe they'll reread their notes. Maybe you'll highlight as you read. These are all reasonably decent practices. I don't mean to say that you shouldn't do these things, but it's a pretty surface level of interaction with an item that will not lead to all that strong of memory, and I want to talk to you about why. So one really strong way of memorization is to use some of the methods used by intentional memorizers, professional intentional memorizers like memory athletes. On slide 8 of the accompanying group here, you'll see a picture of Nelson Dellis, who's a fairly famous memory athlete. They call themselves mnemonists sometimes. Dellis can memorize a deck of cards in a couple minutes. He gives good lectures on how to help your memory, how to advance your memorization capabilities. And if you have the time and you're looking at the slides, I recommend taking something like 30 seconds to study the list of words on slide 10. And then pause this. And once you're finished, try to recall the list perfectly in order. And see how many. You've given yourself the appropriate amount of time. You can't move directly from studying to test. Typically, we'll take like 5, 10, even 30 seconds in between. People will remember usually a maximum of about 9 words in the correct order. Maybe at the beginning, maybe at the end, maybe in the middle. But most people will find themselves in categories A and B if they do this demo properly. And so Dellis and other memory athletes, like a photo I'm showing on slide 13 of Clemens Mayer, can do far more remarkable things than just memorize 12 silly words in a row. They can memorize lists of hundreds of words presented 1 second right after the other and then recall them all accurately in order. And the key to understanding how these people work is that they had more or less average memories before they began training. A classic example from a psychology lab was a professor trained a student named Steve Falloon to memorize digits, so just individual numbers in a row. And when they first started, he could memorize something like 8 or so most days. And then eventually, Steve learned by himself to increase his digit span up to 80 digits. And he did this because he had certain expertises. I think he was a runner or a swimmer, maybe. And so he thought about the number sequences as running or swimming times. And as he combined those over time, he was able to memorize. But most of us would find something like that with given enough time and opportunity to do this kind of memorization, is the basic idea. Another technique, one of the main techniques actually that mnemonists use, is a technique called the Mind Palace. So I recommend having a look at the fun little clip from the BBC's recent Sherlock show, in which he goes into a mind palace. It's not necessarily so visually based, so dramatic maybe as the show shows it. You won't like sort of feel electricity as you're thinking about your mind palace, but it is a real thing. The ancient Greeks called it the method of loci. And the way you do this, the way you develop a mind palace or a memory palace of your own, is you select a highly familiar pathway that has a number of salient landmarks. So a lot of people choose their childhood home, and you could think about like touring the home from the front door to the back door, going through the whole thing in the meantime. Upstairs, if there was upstairs, around in each of the bedrooms, visiting each room in turn. And so the idea is that you would first memorize that pathway, figure out exactly how you were going to walk through that building over days or weeks, just so that you have it landmark by landmark, rock solid. You pick a place in each room where you're going to have a landmark. So then, when you want to memorize a list of any kind, all you have to do is form some kind of multisensory, distinctive, very vivid image of the first item in the list interacting with the first landmark of your pathway. Then you'll form an image of the second item interacting with the second landmark, and so on. And the idea is that then to recall your list, all you have to do is mentally traverse your pathway, walk back through your childhood home. So think about if you had a shopping list to memorize. Let's say it was milk, eggs, and bread. You might imagine on the front step of the house, just as you open the door, maybe sitting in between the door, it's cracked open, is a half gallon of milk that's just barely leaking. It's leaking a little bit. It smells just a little. It's been a little warm today, and so there's the milk sitting just propping your door open. It's not a good idea. You probably want to get it out of there. Then you step inside, and over to the right is a carpeted area that is the living room. And so in the living room is the big couch that the whole family sits on. And on the couch, there for some reason, sit a dozen eggs. They're all spread out around the couch. They have little arms and legs. They're relaxing. They're leaning on the pillows. They imagine maybe they have little noses. They have noses and arms and legs. They're very silly to see. And then as you walk around, you look across to the other side of the room, and on top of the television, there's a loaf of bread that has no heels. You've never seen a loaf of bread like this before. It's not in a bag. It's sitting out, and someone has very kindly removed the heels of the bread for you, so you don't have to eat those all-crust pieces. Or maybe if you like the all-crust pieces, imagine that it's a loaf of bread that is only crust pieces. Ooh, delicious. So now, to recall that list, or any longer list, you would mentally retraverse your pathway. If you'd like an example of this, you can see it happen live when Nelson Dellis teaches a fairly meatballish news presenter, meatball, of course, is how he's acting in this clip, to memorize a deck of cards. It works quite well for a guy who can memorize. I believe he comes out with 0 correct answers when doing it by himself, but after Dellis gives him a small Mind Palace demo, he's able to memorize an entire set of face cards in a deck. So that's something like, Are the aces involved? I think it might just be 12 cards in a row, but far more than zero, of course. So if you've got time, try to do this yourself. Develop a little mind palace in the room around you, and write down or say out loud some remarkable, vivid, multi-sensory images with the second list of words on slide 19. And then give yourself a minute of pause in between the creation and the recall, and try to recall what you can. See if you did better than you did on the first list. For a more fun challenge, try now to remember the first list of words. And at the end of this lecture, try to remember this second list. I'll bet that at that point, you will definitely remember more words from the second than the first if you do these demos. And try again next week. Odds are good that you'll probably just remember cow off the first list. That's all I remember right now. And you'll have a much better memory for the second list because you've interacted with it more. And the reason for that interaction breeds better memory is that your memory is a network. When one node is activated within a network, all the nodes connected to it become somewhat active. Think about it like electrical current passing through a network or activation passing around on a computer network. When you activate a node, you slightly activate all the ones surrounding it. That's why it's much easier to recognize a friend of yours than it is to describe their face out loud to someone. If you tried to describe a friend out loud right now, it'd be kind of difficult. It would take you a minute, especially if I asked you to describe a friend you didn't know, maybe a new friend, somebody you just met. But if you saw either of these people, you'd recognize them instantly, and it would feel very easy. And that's because when you see the person, they activate the network and you're able to recognize. If I ask you to describe, you're generating the network out of nothing. So it's a bit more challenging. It's also the reason that telling a story is easier than regurgitating a list. A story is a natural network. Things move in a timely and sensible fashion to us. And so it's easier to repeat those than to just repeat lists of things. Also the same reason that it's easier to answer a multiple choice question than a short answer question. In multiple choice, all you have to do is recognize. In short answer, you have to actually produce. You have to do what we call recall in memory research. An example of the power of the networked nature of memory is shown in the following question. And the question is, what were you doing exactly 3 years ago today? Probably hard to know for sure, right? But if you knew what day of the week it was, and you know exactly what date it is, and you know what year it was, you could probably make a pretty darn accurate guess, right? You know where you were living, you know what you were doing most days back then, and so you could maybe even guess down to the hour, potentially. You could probably have a pretty darn good guess for most of what you did 3 years ago today, and that's because memory's network is usually quite powerful. Endel Tolving went so far as to call remembering mental time traveling. He said that we are reenacting a prior pattern of brain or mind activity, and in that way he called it something like literally remembering. You have these members, these pieces of a memory, and you need to reassemble them. And that's the reason that memory benefits from external cues. If you experience something, you very naturally process all those external cues that go on while you're experiencing it. And so bringing back those cues are going to make it easier to remember the meat of the memory as well. Think about like a time, a particular song that transports you to a particular time in your life. When I hear, what's a good one? My senior year of high school, I listened to the Red Hot Chili Peppers, Mars and Jupiter album, Stadium Arcadium album, over and over and over. And so most of those songs make me think about like a really nice spring day driving home from high school. Or think about a perfume sometimes. These are both external type cues, right? I'm not remembering because I'm driving home or because it's springtime or because it's sunny or because I'm in high school. The external cue of the music is what's cueing me. And so think about perfume. It works similarly. The smell could be an external cue that might remind you of an old flame, might help you remember a meal you had once, all those kinds of things. And we know that external cues are helpful for memory from work done by Gooden and Baddeley in the 70s. This was the original landmark study in this field. They had a group of scuba divers study a list of words. So they split the group in half. Half of the group studied the words on the shore. The other group studied the words in their scuba gear underwater. Later, the two groups were then split in half again. Half of each group was tested on the shore. The other half was tested in their scuba gear underwater. And what you see in the outcome here is that the group that studied and tested in the same location recalled more words than the group that studied in one location and then were tested in the other, even if that location was underwater, which should conceivably be a little bit more difficult because you're focusing on a lot of other things than just the words in front of you. But that, nonetheless, was the case. And this is because, again, to remember is to make aspects of a current pattern of activity in your mind resemble a prior pattern. And so if you can repeat the external features of that pattern, then you can make it easier to recall the internal and critical features of that pattern. And that's why being in the same room helps, being in the same mood can help, being in the same mental state can help. It actually becomes even more important to have some of those external cues if a test that you're taking or if the memory you're trying to generate has fewer cues in it itself. So like if you're taking an essay test, it's going to require a lot more recall on your own than if you take a multiple choice test, because a multiple choice test is full of cues to memory. Also presented on this slide is an idea that will come up again later, but it's this idea that the more uniquely similar a pattern is, the more unique in general a pattern is, the easier it's going to be to recall that, because generating a new pattern of mental activity that is similar to that same old unique pattern is going to be a little easier. This is the reason we suggest distinctiveness in things like memory palace images. Just to nail this home one more time, there's some other interesting data from the 60s in which a researcher named Goodwin had people study a list of words either sober or intoxicated, and then split them in half, the two groups in half, and had each group either test sober or intoxicated. And so here I'm showing you a number of errors. So the key is that the people who studied sober and tested sober made very few errors. Make that your main takeaway. But notice that the people who were forced to study drunk actually made fewer errors on the test when they also tested drunk. So I want your main takeaway to be always study and test sober. But if you're in the unfortunate situation where you studied drunk, I guess you may as well take the test drunk. But this is to say that being in the same state, being in the same mood, can help memory. Fergus Craik presented a similar idea around the same time, which he called levels of processing. And the central thesis of this is that the action of memorization can move from shallow to deep. There are shallow methods of memorization, and there are deep methods of memorization. If you focus on superficial appearance-based features of the thing you're trying to memorize, you're processing it in a rather shallow way. But if you think about the meaning-based or the conceptual nature of the thing you're trying to memorize, you're processing it much more deeply. And if you can do that, then you will have much better memory for that element. And that is, it's true. Lots of research shows that it's true. But it can fall apart if the test is designed in a particular way that it asks for memory of the superficial aspects. So keep that in mind. Always know what your test is going to be. The next piece of the memorized event that is really important for encouraging and maintaining strong memory of it is knowledge of the context. Now, if you read the transcript, the paragraph on slide 29, it might be really hard to figure out what on earth that person is talking about. And when you don't understand what they're talking about, it's going to be hard to memorize a paragraph that's written something like this. On the other hand, if you look in the notes section for that slide, or if you listen for another second, I'll tell you that the context for that paragraph is information about flying a kite. And so what we see in the lab is that people who are told that this paragraph is about flying a kite before they hear it remember the details of it much, much better than people who aren't told that it's details about flying a kite. So context is important, understanding is important, knowing where information is coming from and what it applies to is really, really important for memorization. Slide 31 has another such example. In the notes section, there is a transcript. The researchers read the transcript to all their participants, but they showed the image on the slide to only half of their participants. And so if you compare memory performance for the items in the transcript, the group that had the image for context information vastly outperforms the group that doesn't. Same basic outcome. This second one is work by Johnson and Bransford, who are pictured on slide 31. And this is another important feature of the networked nature of memory. If you can connect the material you're trying to learn to things you already know, that's going to support deep, rich, elaborative encoding and give you different avenues to retrieve the information. So if you don't understand something, it's going to be hard to recall it. A couple final notes here. Roddy Roediger has spent many years lending large amounts of evidence to the fact that testing is a very powerful way to learn, a very powerful way to memorize. If you have the opportunity to read something over and over, and you have the opportunity to take a test about something over and over, and the end task will be to take a test, I recommend you take the test over and over to study for taking the test. And so that sort of leads us to the biggest suggestion of this entire slide deck, which is to design tests for yourself. If you're studying and it's not doing what you need, you should change from whatever you're doing to designing practice tests for yourself. That is the best way to ensure good and long-lasting memorization. Because if you can activate the GIF on slide 34, if you study by reading, rereading notes or text, textbooks, that would kind of be like practicing speed skating to get ready to be a hockey player. You'd get better, definitely. You'd be a faster skater, so you'd be a better hockey player. But it would not help you do what Philippe Forsberg does in this clip. You would not get all the skills you need. You have to actually play the game. And that is the same. That metaphor applies directly to studying. If you're reading and rereading, you are speed skating. So you'll be faster. You'll be a faster hockey player, but you won't necessarily be all that much better of one at the test than you would have or could have been if you had tested yourself along the way. Some other researchers have made other very important contributions to memory that can help us. Bob Bjork has worked for a long time showing that desirable difficulties seem to promote recall. So if you're studying and it feels very easy, it feels very fluid, maybe you feel like you're in an athletics type flow state, you're probably not learning anything new. You're probably not memorizing anything new. It should feel a little tough, but it shouldn't feel impossible. So when you get to that point of just a little frustrated of actually figuring something out yourself, you're in the place of desirable difficulties, and that will help you memorize. Janet Metcalf likewise has a lot of great work on what she calls the region of proximal learning. And this is related to the idea that you have to understand what you're learning. If you can draw metaphors, if you can use information from somewhere else to inform the learning that you're doing, you're always gonna have more success memorizing and then retrieving those elements after. So in summary, I have a couple of basic pieces of advice. Number one, practice how you'll be tested. Make practice tests, get yourself to produce the knowledge rather than just letting yourself recognize the knowledge, and that will lead you to much, much better test performance, no doubt. Try to get to a place of deep and distinctive processing, because that is the thing that leads to long-term memorization through understanding. If you can apply imagery to the work you're doing, go for it. Build a story around it. Make it clear, make it distinctive, make it vivid. Use all of your senses, make it a multi-sensory story. Try to link what you're learning to things you know well. Generate your own examples is one of the really excellent ways to listen to a lecture. As the lecturer presents an example, try to come up with your own and see if it fits. Ask the person if it fits. Also, consider drawing a concept map. Figure out how the different items of what you're learning link together. See whether one thing leads to another, what the subcategories of one or another piece are. Another thing we know that I've not previously mentioned here is to space out your study episodes. This is from old work that Ebbinghaus did in the 1800s. If you cram everything into one study night, yes, you will know some stuff the next day, but it will all go away very, very quickly. But if you study many, many times over a longer period of time, you will slowly build up your knowledge in a way that will stick much, much longer. And then the last piece of advice I have also isn't super evident in the rest of this lecture, which is to study in as many different ways and places as you can. Some of that kind of contextual effect can serve to affect people negatively if they always study in the same place. So if you're always doing all your studying and working in one particular room, and then you suddenly have to test in a different room, it won't hurt you much, but it might hurt you a tiny bit. So if you can space out all the places you study and all the ways you study, all the moods, all the smells, all the clothes, whatever it is, then when you get to the testing facility or the testing scenario, it won't feel strange because you'll have studied in so many different places. You'll escape from this concept we call transfer appropriate processing. You'll make context an unimportant factor. I've tweeted most of today's points. You can find that far back in the @MarioBaldessari Twitter feed. There's links to other places to think about these ideas in the final slide there. Thanks for listening. Have a good one.